I think it's very interesting that I don't know how many people here, as a matter of interest, have read Schrödinger's famous papers on creation of wave mechanics. And it's great that John has just come in, because it was John who recommended me that I should read them. Because do you remember at that meeting in Moscow, you were in the coffee queue behind John Wheeler and someone else and myself, and I was asking, why do we have complex numbers in quantum mechanics? And Wheeler and Jim Hartle both said it was to describe interference. I said, well, that can't be the explanation, because they described interference with a real wave equation for 100 years and never thought of making it complex. And you said to me, you've probably completely forgotten it, John, I don't know the answer, but I can tell you where to find it. And one place you suggested was in the Feynman lectures, and the other was in Schrödinger's original papers in which he created wave mechanics.
That's right.
And well, the answer is very interesting. First of all, I couldn't find anywhere in Feynman where it was laid out, but I didn't look terribly hard. But then I did read, and it turned into one of the great events of my life, was the Schrödinger papers on wave mechanics. And there's one or two things which I think are very interesting to make about that. First of all, Schrödinger, first of all, found his time-independent Schrödinger equation, the one that describes stationary states. And very interestingly, the first results in scattering theory were obtained by Max Born using the time-independent Schrödinger equation. Somehow or other, he knew instinctively how to do it. And there's a nice footnote in Born's papers where he says, I could never have done this mathematics without the help of the very kind Norbert Wiener, who was his student visiting at the time. And it's not until the last paper that Schrödinger says, I've now got to introduce time into my equation, because he believed there was time. And he'd already got this time-independent Schrödinger equation, which has second spatial derivatives in it. And he said, if I go about this in the obvious way, I shall have to have second time derivatives and fourth spatial derivatives. And this is rather inconvenient, awkward mathematically. It physically makes sense, but I don't want to do it. So I'm going to cheat, he says. I'm going to introduce a complex wave function. So he just introduces a complex wave function, and he writes down the famous I d by dt term, essentially. Psi by dt. Or something like that. At the end of it, he says, well, everything in this quantum theory I've developed is satisfactory, except for this very ugly thing of the complex numbers, and I apologize for them. And he left it at that. 7 years later, Ehrenfest was nearly going mad worrying about why there are complex numbers in quantum mechanics, and was trying to get anybody of the great founding fathers to put him out of his misery. In the end, of course, he put himself out of his misery very soon after. Nobody would take any interest in why there were complex numbers now, except for Pauli. And Pauli said, you've got to make the answer, you've got to make your question really precise. Pauli said that there are lots of possible wave theories which would lead to quantum type effect. You would have this, you would have things like the uncertainty relation, you would have things like the connection between wavelength and momentum in any quite large class of wave theories. But he says, what is the specific difference of quantum mechanics, he says. And he says that if you've got to be very precise. He says, if you want to have a probability density that depends upon the wave function and not on it, so it's a function of x. Some probability function which depends upon the wave function as a function of the wave function, but not on its time derivatives, and the total probability is conserved, then you've got to have a complex wave equation, was what Pauli gave. So it's unitarity. So really what Pauli's answer was, that it's really unitarity, is that thing that is expressing the role of complex numbers. And perhaps you can turn it around in different ways. Now, it's a long time since I looked at this. Somebody I talked to recently who seemed to know what they were talking about said, that's not a very satisfactory answer. Now, there are very other things which are interesting in terms of complex numbers. One particular, Bill Wooters' thing, has a very nice observation about trying to do quantum mechanics with either real complex or quaternionic fields. And in the case of, if you have a complete system which is made up of two systems, and you make observations on the two subsystems separately, can you reconstruct the total state? And Bill Wooters was able to show that you can do that precisely if you have a complex Hilbert space. But if you have a quaternionic, I think you have too much information, and if you have real, you have too little. And that seems to characterize this very subtle balance of complex, of local and non-local stuff that you have in quantum mechanics. So there's maybe something that was very deep there. And of course, there are very interesting properties of complex numbers. Now, the thing that got me going on all this is that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in canonical quantum gravity is a real linear equation. It looks just like the Klein-Gordon equation, or also a little bit like the time-independent Schrödinger equation. And I noticed, actually, another reason why I got interested in complex numbers, at the in 1987, for the 100th anniversary of the birth of Schrödinger, they had a big conference in Imperial, which seven Nobel Prize winners spoke. And Yang spoke specifically on the role of complex numbers in quantum mechanics. And it stimulated me and gave me a great deal of interest in it. But I don't think Yang actually gave the correct explanation of the role, what complex numbers are doing in quantum mechanics. And I am always asking people, perhaps later on somebody can give some, has got some clear ideas. But I think it's a, that's an interesting, a very interesting issue. What exactly, in the way of empirical facts that we know from the laboratory, says that you've got to have complex numbers, or that specific mathematical structure, it might be a complex structure rather than specifically just complex numbers, that forces us to that? And I think it's very relevant, given that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is real. And about 20 years ago, I started reading papers on quantum cosmology. And I saw, to my amazement, that people would just take Friedman, Robertson, Walker, and they would have a wave function of the universe, which was just e to the IA, where A is the scale factor, something like this in essence. And then they would say, oh, that's an expanding universe, and e to the minus IA is a contracting universe. And you can find that in lots of papers that were written about 20 years ago. I don't know whether people have stopped saying things like that. But I took one look at that and I said, this is just complete nonsense, surely. The only reason that you can associate a direction of motion with a momentum eigenstate is because of that id by dt. And when Schrödinger introduced it, he says it's completely conventional whether I put a plus or minus there. But if that's gone, how on earth do we... There's just no meaning to that. It clearly is complete nonsense. And then it went... It gets worse, because they wanted to, this was all part of the program to show how you could recover the time-dependent Schrödinger equation out of something like the time-independent Schrödinger equation. So basically what they did was assume that you had, shall we say, a heavy degree of freedom, and a light degree of freedom. And you would have a wave function which depended upon these 2 degrees of freedom of the form e to the IS, depending on just the heavy degree of freedom. So this is a sort of WKB solution for the heavy degrees of freedom, multiplied by some other function which depends upon the heavy and the light degrees of freedom. So the assumption is that the heavy degrees of freedom would get into the WKB regime, and then there would be some interaction between the heavy and the light degrees of freedom, which would be described by this wave function. And if you assume, if you make this assumption, that that is a complex wave function, then you can show that for some approximation, this thing will satisfy a time-dependent Schrödinger equation with respect to a time which is defined by this thing here. These are the lines, so you've got lines of constant phase, and the lines orthogonal to that, as you know from Hamilton's great discovery, describe classical trajectories. And the time that you recover out of the WKB approximation can be used as a time to recover this I d by dt, d psi by dt term. And that works to some extent. There's messy additional terms, correction terms, which I don't know whether they've ever been sort of satisfactorily sorted out. And I've no objection to the idea that the wave function of the universe gets into a WKB regime. I discussed this with Bryce DeWitt, and he thought that wasn't an unreasonable assumption. But what I do object to is this assumption here. Because what is actually happening in ordinary quantum mechanics, where we, in the laboratory, we know it's described by the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Well, what is happening, what the id by dt term does, is it creates a kind of ping-pong between the real and the imaginary parts. The time derivative of the real part is found by applying the Laplacian to the imaginary part and vice versa, so that the real and imaginary parts are playing ping-pong with each other. And if they get into, if the system gets into the WKB regime, it forces the real and imaginary parts to be exactly 90 degrees out of phase. And that's exactly what happens here. So this thing is a dynamical consequence of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation if it gets into the WKB regime. But if you don't start off with something like the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, what on earth is the justification for making such an assumption? So I think all of these attempts to derive the time-dependent Schrödinger equation from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation fail for that reason.
Are you just saying in that case, sort of assuming the answer?
You're assuming the answer. You're just putting in the answer. It's quite clear. And people, I mean, in fact, my papers don't get cited all that much, but my observations on this have, and both Chris Isham and Carol Kuchasch, who were the sort of leading figures in quantum gravity 20 years ago, both of them picked this up and said this is a serious point and a serious issue. And it's one of the things I keep on wanting to go back to and try and understand this thing, because it seems to me that my view about quantum gravity is that it's a terrifically long haul. I don't think I'm going to see quantum gravity in my lifetime, and I'm pretty hopeful for your sake to keep you all busy and happy for all of yours, those of the younger generation. But it seems to me that there are just one or two places where there might be a quick, spectacular breakthrough, and it seems to me that just possibly it is something to do with what role, how the complex numbers would come into quantum gravity, why they must be used. Maybe it would give us some hint that something like the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is completely wrong. I personally take the Wheeler-DeWitt equation very seriously. I think there are very, if I don't know how many of you are coming to the colloquium talk I'm giving next Wednesday, but I'll be arguing for a way of understanding the structure of general relativity, which in my mind makes the Wheeler-DeWitt equation very, very plausible and considerable likelihood that it is, that you have to take it seriously in quantum gravity. But maybe something to do, some insight into the role of complex numbers would change that view. We would get some insight. And quite apart from that, I think it's extremely interesting to try and pin down these things. I mean, every now and then I say, no, I really must study these things and look at it, but of course I never find time to do it. But I often ask people, why do we have to have complex numbers? And the only sort of real answers that I've got so far are the ones from the one that Pauli gave to Ehrenfest and Bill Wooters type thing. I take it that what Bill Wooters is saying is that this is an experimentally known fact about the behavior when you've got two quantum systems and then you make measurements on two separately. That would seem to me to be something that is definitely confirmed in the laboratory. But John? Well, interference is explained by a real wave function.
I used another complex algebra. Since you know there are four different algebras, five, four intermediate ones. This one is based on Z equals X plus omega Y. Omega squared is equal to 1, not minus 1. But omega has a conjugate. So Z squared equals X squared minus 1. So it's a complex. And if you use that to do quantum effects, it doesn't work.
That's not a division algebra, it's a ring.
That's good. It's a division algebra.
Well, you can't. No, it's not a division algebra. It's
no, it's not. It has a singularity.
Yes.
But it does, that doesn't match it for me to do quantum
effects. I'm afraid I'm out of my depth there, but maybe someone. Yeah.
There's another very, very complex number. So the I squared is very important when you do the double sequence. The complex number squared has to be minus 1. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
So are you saying, but surely the double slit experiment is no different from. Is it any different from Young's original experiments, which would explain perfectly well with just a real wave, with a wave equation?
Yeah, but the point is that the quantum mechanics have this, of course, to shift the whole issue of quantum mechanics. The ambiguity is the way it's supposed
to. It's the complementarity that you get hits as opposed to a continuous distribution, which is not, I mean, the going through the two slits is perfectly all right in classical wave theory. Am I not right in that? It seems to me that of course there are more things in quantum mechanics, but I don't see that forces one. I mean, I would really be delighted if somebody could show me this is completely inexplicable unless we have a quantum thing. But it seems to me perhaps that Bill Wooters' one is the closest that we get. But because if the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is right and we have something like a static wave function of the universe, well, unitarity is not going to come into play because there's no time evolution. So the Pauli-type argument by unitarity would rule it out. But nevertheless, we live in the universe, we make actual measurements, and we get these results that Bill Wooters is talking about. Right? Yeah?
Can I ask a question to make sure I understand what you're saying? So you're not disputing that the Schrodinger equation is measured by experiments. That's not what you're saying. You're rather asking how come we can't find a formulation of theory where we only use real numbers? Is that what you're asking?
Well, let me try and be a bit more. Let's see if I can be really precise in this. Well, first of all, I mean, one of the things I also want to do, I just mentioned briefly that the first scattering results in quantum mechanics were obtained by Born using the time-independent Schrödinger equation. So there's no complex numbers in that. And I don't know how much of quantum mechanics can be done with time-independent scattering theory. But I think a big hunk of it and a lot of the work is actually done in that way. It's something I've not got around to really looking at. So what I would like to know is exactly when you have to say you cannot get by without using complex numbers. And I suspect that, John?
In physics, you always know which state the photon goes through.
Ah, if you have particles, John, but not if you've got a classical wave. And that's all you need to explain interference. This was in that queue at the Sakharov conference in Moscow when I was unsatisfied with Wheeler and Jim Hartle's answer. And you said you didn't know, but you told me where to look. But I still didn't give me the answer, but it was well worth doing.
Does it have to do with the connectivity of SO2? There's arguments around having to rotate through 4 pi in order to return the identity.
Well, right. Yes. So, and might this then all be in things like in say the spin statistics theorem and so forth that you really couldn't get around it there?
So it has to do with the SO3, SO31.
Yes. Yes.
Why do you need
the complex numbers only come in when you're dealing with spinners?
But that's a different. I mean, one thing I did get round to organizing a one-day conference in Oxford about 16 years ago, where Chris Isham, Gary Gibbons, one of Rogers Penrose's collaborators, and a few others came. And at the end of the day, we identified lots of uses of complex numbers. Of course, in spinners, they are . But in no cases did we actually succeed in pinning down what we really thought, why they were essential in quantum mechanics, why they were there. Certainly, I don't know when Bill Waters had his scheme there, whether that came up there. But yeah?
But Mark, you can demonstrate the double cover classically.
Well, that's true.
So, I don't see why that's an argument that says you have to use complex numbers.
No, well, in fact, you can take an algebraic approach, and you know, I is just simple.
Yes. Yes. No. 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 That's not my point. I mean, because I think we always have to go back to Pauli's statement that you must make your question really precise. It's no good just sort of talking in general terms. Of course, you can always represent a complex number, but it's how you do it and what other restrictions you put on the system, and then something comes out. I mean, I think Pauli's answer is in principle much more satisfying if it would work for the Wheeler-DeWitt type situation, where he says unitarity is something that is confirmed experimentally, and that unitarity is the thing rather than just complex numbers. And maybe there are other things that one could identify. In one way, yes, we are talking about numbers of degrees of freedom, I should think. But I really apologize for actually rather asking questions than providing any answers, because I think it's something that is interesting and should be thought about. Sean?
Just to go back to Florian's point, or question, is your point that why is it that we have Schrodinger equation, which works well for substance? And it seems to me complex numbers. When if we look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is supposed to apply to the entire universe, it doesn't seem to need complex numbers at all.
That's basically my question, yes. That the introduction of complex solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation would be very artificial. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that you could even do it. How are you going to ensure that you get them exactly to, because there's nothing that links them together. They're completely independent. So there's no real reason why you should do that.
Is an equivalent statement to what Sean just said, that in the lab, why do you need this quantum potential and Bohmian language, whereas you don't need it in the other case?
Well, perhaps, yes, but...
When you say you need complex numbers, I can take Schrodinger and just write as real times imaginary...
No, that's not what I'm... No, this...
What is it when you say we need them in what sense? This is still confusing to me.
Well, it's confusing to me in that I'm not able to give a clear identification of where they really do seem to be needed. That's my...
Well, but if I break up Schrodinger into R e to the is, and I can write it, and I can take real and imaginary parts, and you get this pair of couple equations, and what makes it different is I get this grad S squared type term, which is the so-called Bohmian potential.
Yeah.
And whether you believe in Bohm or not, I could forget I ever heard of complex numbers, and I would get this thing that goes like H bar squared, if I remember. So... In that language, is your question, why do I need that extra potential?
That might be.
What's could, that doing for me?
I suppose.
What the question would be.
Yeah. I mean, my feeling is that out in the world, that there must be something, a characteristic property, which is very conveniently represented by that ID by DT term in the Schrodinger equation. And I'm just wanting to understand exactly what it is and why it is so naturally leading to this characteristic structure, which Schrodinger actually initially was very unhappy about. He didn't like introducing it, was very apologetic. All right.
Here's another angle. You were saying before that when you're working with a real individual equation, there's no reason really to introduce a complex field of the wave function, right? But then if I think of attempts to define quantum gravity, take, for example, the case where you have connection variables, like SU2 or SO4 or SO31, when I want to define a general functional of a connection, it may be natural to have a complex function. Like if I take polynomials and I take traces, I construct them in certain ways, wouldn't it be natural that
I'm not sufficiently familiar with that approach to have
Just given that natural variables in our theories are connections, like there are SU2 connections, there are SU3 connections, and in a quantum theory, if I'm in the Schrodinger picture, I have to construct states that are functionals of these configuration variables.
That doesn't.
I have to make up some functionals of these configurations. Could be that it's actually quite natural to have complex values coming out.
Conceivably, but I'm not sufficiently familiar with that to really give an opinion. Yeah.
One very small question. If you feel uncomfortable about ID by DT, do you not feel uncomfortable about minus ID by DX? I mean, it always seemed to me that this is just a piece of the uncertainty principle. Well, this is the way to describe what goes into for infinitesimal changes or something like that of a wave function. It's certainly a great convenience, but the ID by DT just gives you an energy statement. The D by DX will give you a momentum statement. One is as basic as another, it always seemed to me.
Well, except that they come in through the Laplacian for the ID by DT, so that it sort of, in some senses, disappears in the momentum things because of the two coming together. Whereas the ID by DT,
that's only non-relativistic.
Non-relativistic. Well, another one is yes. Well, maybe the answer's there, but I would. I'm standing here exhibiting my ignorance, but I haven't managed to get, as yet, really clear answers to this. And all I can say, I haven't checked the literature recently, but certainly 20 years ago, quite distinguished people, I think, were writing just straight nonsense and should have known better. That's really what I want to say.
With the E to the IA, E to the minus, I agree completely.
Yeah, yes.
It depends upon your boundary conditions.
All sorts of things. Yes.
All sorts of things.
Yes. Shall we perhaps leave that, because that's perhaps enough of that. And in fact, on this basis, I've only got 10 more minutes to do that. Rather than going to talk about scale invariance, let me talk about an idea which carries on naturally from from this thing. May I ask how many, if any, have read my book, The End of Time? Two people or three people. No, four or five. But let me talk about an idea which came out of that, out of this thing. John, again, I have to thank you. I made quite a lot of money with The End of Time. And again, I have to thank you because I think I wouldn't have done it without the stimulus that came from Schrödinger's thing. One thing that came out of this was then, if we take the Wheeler-DeWitt equation seriously, and there's a wave function of the universe, where does the information reside that makes us think we're in an expanding universe rather than a contracting universe? And clearly, when people said that's an expanding universe and that's a contracting one, they thought that that information is encoded in the phase relations in a complex wave function, just as it is in a momentum eigenstate. And I thought that can't be right. And for a long time, I thought, where is it? And I remember I used to ask people, suppose I were to drop dead now and go down into Plato's cave, and here were mathematicians looking at the solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. How would I tell that it's describing an expanding universe? Or would it be a many worlds thing where there would be expanding and contracting? Where would the information reside? And suddenly, it was a day after finishing Schrödinger's papers, reading him, that the idea came to me. It doesn't reside in the phase relations in the wave function. It resides in the configurations of the universe that get the highest probability. And I still think that's probably the right answer. And I coined the expression time capsule for such configurations. And I define a time capsule as being a configuration of the universe which we would interpret as containing lots and lots of mutually consistent records of a past. We would look at that configuration and say, this configuration has arisen through a dynamical process, which is some curious mixture of classical and quantum mechanics, and a very special initial condition, a very, very special initial condition. And I call such a configuration a time capsule. And in fact, this is exactly how the geologists came to conclude that the Earth is immensely ancient. Long before the physicists, they looked at the geological strata and the fossils and all these things, and they said, and did all sorts of calculations. And I forget what their initial estimate was, but it was a great deal longer than Lord Kelvin estimated on the basis of his theory of the sun. And in fact, everything we know about the past is contained in mutually consistent records in the present. So that's my notion of a time capsule. And then the other thing, which also, again, from reading the Schrödinger paper, Schrödinger at one point makes some comment, like he talks about the natural boundaries of the configuration space. But suddenly in a flash, it came to me that any configuration space, but particularly a one that only contains relative quantities, is highly structured and highly asymmetric. Unlike Euclidean space, there are very distinguished points, and there are very distinguished directions in any configuration space. In the three-body problem, which is the example I already give, you have where the three particles are sitting on top of each other. That's an extremely distinguished point. Then you have the configurations where two particles are sitting on top of each other, and one is at some distance away. And then you have the collinear configurations, three on a line. And then you have the general ones. And then you have the isosceles triangles, and you have the equilateral triangles. And this seems to me an incredibly rich structure. And when you go to the n-body problem, it's even richer. It's unbelievably rich structure. And to my knowledge, I've never, ever seen anybody comment on this until this idea occurred to me. Has anybody else seen it stated in the literature that a configuration space is highly asymmetrical? It seems to me this is one of these things staring us in the face, which we don't see. And if you think about it, in our life, there's one really great asymmetry in our life, and that is the difference between the past and the future. It's a colossal asymmetry. And now we look at one of the most basic concepts in physics, the configuration space, and it's highly asymmetrical, and it has a distinguished point, which I take to be the Big Bang. It's not in the past, it's just in a different place in the configuration space. And in ways, I think the configuration space is sort of made into the Cinderella, the poor sister of the other more exciting, sexy spaces, phase space, space-time, and Hilbert space. Those are the ones that most theoretical physicists get excited about. But I think, in a way, the configuration space is more fundamental. And I mentioned this once to Cecile DeWitt, and she said, oh, Bryce always said that. Bryce is convinced about that. My broad conjecture, which I'm still very far from being able to have any hope of proving, is that somehow or other, if you have a static wave function on a configuration space, the realistic configuration space for the universe, it will actually concentrate the wave function on these time capsules. And that quantum gravity will be a thing which makes structures, interesting structures, that look as if they've emerged from something very uniform, likely. That quantum gravity will be the exact opposite of classical mechanics. We know that all statistical arguments applied to classical mechanics make it seem that we're going to live in an uninteresting world with a lot of uninteresting random junk around the place. Whereas my conjecture is that that's the opposite situation. And I'd also make the point that before the scientific revolution, there was this concept of the well-ordered cosmos. Philosophers were amazed by the beautiful structure in the universe. And the first task of the philosophers was to explain, where does this structure come from? This is the myth of order out of chaos. And love, Cupid is the oldest and the youngest of the deities, because it was love that brought order out of chaos. But Cupid is a blind boy. Just been reading Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost, where this is explained in a footnote. So I think, for me, the real significance of Schrödinger's time-independent Schrödinger equation is that he found the law that creates structure in the universe. That's really the fundamental thing. And that maybe we should go back to a pre-Newtonian age where you don't have this dichotomy between laws of motion and initial conditions. And you just have one law, which, as the first principle, creates structures and makes one structure more probable than another. So that's my idea. And just I will just say one thing about scale invariance, which is worth mentioning. The three-body problem, or the n-body problem in Newtonian physics, is very interesting. One of the problems I find for many theoretical physicists, but above all relativists, is that in your mechanics courses, you're taught two-body Newtonian mechanics and rigid body mechanics. And there's very little discussion of the three-body problem or the n-body problem. Really, when you talk to, and I have interacted with some of the top n-body specialists of the world. And in fact, let me just make one of my claims to fame. I did interact with Richard Montgomery, who was one of the joint. Do people know about the famous figure of eight solution to the three-body problem? Who knows about that? This was Sean, does it? Yeah. Oh, you don't? No. 8 years ago, Richard Montgomery, who's at Santa Cruz, and Alain Chansonnier in France discovered a new solution, and a very interesting solution, to the three-body problem, in which three particles of equal masses follow each other around in a figure of eight pattern. If you look in, if you put in the name Chancenaire and Montgomery in Google, you'll get they're called choreographies now, and there's more general solutions of them. I played a small part in that. You'll find I'm thanked for an inspirational discussion with Richard Montgomery for it. That's the most exciting solution to the three-body problem since Lagrange's time, amazingly.
This is a classical.
It's a classical solution.
What are the interactions? It's
Newtonian gravity.
Newtonian gravity.
Newtonian gravity for three particles, and they follow each other. But now you can get more than three particles, and they all follow each round. And they're called choreographies, and you can see nice animations of them that somebody called Carlos Simó in Barcelona did. You had a question.
They're not stable.
Beg your pardon?
Stable?
No. I think there's a bit of stability. Yes, there's a little margin of stability. I think the full details I don't know. I think there's a margin of stability, but certainly they caused a lot of excitement when they were discovered. And the reason Richard just says had an inspirational discussion with him. He says he can't pin down what it was, but we'd spent the whole morning talking about my ideas about the three-body problem and the configuration space and scale invariance. And he said it suddenly fell into place in the afternoon, the last bit of it. Unfortunately, very few people know anything about the n-body problem, but that's actually where dynamics begins with the three-body problem. And it's an immensely rich field. But there is one very interesting thing, which is the following. The Newtonian gravitational potential is homogeneous of degree minus 1, 1 upon r. And whenever you have a homogeneity property of the potential, you get interesting results coming out. And one of the consequences of this is intuitively you would think that the behavior of the three-body problem or the n-body problem is determined by the Newtonian gravitational potential. You would think that that's sort of somehow you would feel that that's what's governing things. This is actually completely untrue. The qualitative behavior, all of the sort of fundamental properties of the three-body problem are governed by what's called the scale-invariant gravitational potential, which is this thing multiplied by the square root of I, where I is the moment of inertia of the system about the center of mass. And there's a beautiful expression for that which Leibniz discovered, Sedi Machian. It's I less than J, M I, M J, R I, J squared divided by the total mass. That's the expression for I. And this quantity is dimensionless. And it is this which determines essentially the behavior of the three-body problem. All the asymptotic states of the three-body problem are critical values of this function here. And one of the most interesting things is, and this was discovered by Lagrange, is that this quantity has an absolute maximum at the equilateral triangle for any values of the mass. And then there are now let me just say a little bit about collisions in the shall I go on about 5 more minutes? Is that okay? There are things called total collisions or central collisions in the n-body problem and the three-body problem. In the three-body problem, if two particles collide, that's no problem mathematically. You can extend the solution beyond the collision. They bounce back again. The three-body collision is rather like gravitational collapse in general relativity. You cannot continue the solution beyond the three-body collision, where all the three particles collide together. It can only happen if the angular momentum is zero. And what is really fascinating, you have something which is a little bit like the no-hair theorem in general relativity. If the three-body system gets into a collision where all the three particles collide, well, first of all, before it gets there, it becomes chaotic. It's very chaotic behavior. And it jumps, as in the Kasner solutions in general relativity, between four states. One is the equilateral triangle shape of the triangle, and the other is the so-called Euler solutions, which is the collinear solution, where this thing, so the equilateral triangle is where this thing has its absolute maximum. It's negative and it has absolute maximum. And the Euler ones is where there are saddle points, and where one of this thing has a saddle point, and one of the particles is between the other two, and the position depends upon the masses of the particles. And those are the Euler solutions. And so these are four critical points of this thing here. And if you were to hold the particles in the positions, which only depend upon the shape and not the size, in the positions where these have critical points, and let them go from rest, they fall straight down to the central collision without changing the shape. So it's a self-similar solution there. But if it's not exactly at the critical point, you have wild chaotic behavior, and it jumps around, and then it will finally enter the collision. But it won't necessarily enter the collision. This is, in fact, how globular clusters evaporate in three-body collisions when they get into this chaotic state. And then what happens is that two of the particles get very closely bound together, and the other gets a lot of energy and is kicked out of the globular cluster. So this is very relevant to cosmology issues there. But what is interesting is that if you have a theory which is based on Newtonian gravity, where the scale in this, it's not a scale invariant theory, the distinguished point in the configuration space, there's very violent behavior there, and it's where everybody's sitting on top of each other. If you go to a scale invariant theory, and I've produced the scale invariant form of this thing, it has to have potentials which are, if anybody's interested, I won't get into talking about it now because I'll go on too long otherwise. But you can see it all in a paper of mine which came out in Classical and Quantum Gravity in 2002. You can make a very interesting theory of a scale invariant form of the theory where the potentials are homogeneous of degree minus two. They have to be of degree minus two. But the interesting thing about that is that the distinguished point is now the most symmetric state of the system. It's the equilateral triangle, or in the four-body problem, it's the tetrahedron with equal size. And there the dynamics is perfectly regular. There's nothing strange happening at all. And I'll just end with the thing that Roger Penrose is always saying, is from a statistical mechanics point of view, we seem to live in a universe which started with an unbelievably special state. I mean, Roger does this famous calculation. It's EXP to the minus 123 or something. It's the probability of us being in the state that we are. And I just wonder whether this mystery couldn't be resolved in a scale invariant theory where the reason why we seem to emerge from an extremely uniform state, which would be very unlikely from the point of view of classical statistical mechanics, is something to do with scale invariance, and that in a scale invariant theory, that distinguished point in any configuration space is actually the most uniform state that you can have. I find that a very suggestive thing, and I think I'll stop at that point. I've slightly overrun time, but there were quite good questions in the meanwhile. John?
Yeah, I forgot to mention that basic equations, physical fundamental equations, use equation character. And very low time loss. So you have the Schrodinger equation, t goes into minus t, the height goes into minus r.
Yes. It's time reversal is anti-unitary, isn't it? Yes, but it's still time reversal invariant, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Oh
no, no, you've got irreversible. Oh yes, yes, yes. You've got the heat diffusion
also
equation.
This time reversal invariant disappears from the second order.
That's not time reversal. No. Well, my hope is that my ideas about the special role of the distinguished point would actually explain the second law of thermodynamics, but I think that's getting too much.
Just a remark or two, because these ideas are so, to me, they're so novel, and I've never heard them expressed before. But if you even begin to talk about Big Bang as a point in the universe creation, it seems to me that you needn't worry about unitarity. I mean, there's certainly nothing that you can even possibly imagine that came before, unless you say the universe has a Big Bang and then it has a white collapse and keeps on. But that's just speculation.
Yeah.
That's just one comment. I mean, you were talking about unitarity at the beginning as a
possible
reason why you need I.
Yes.
If you don't need, if you carry your thoughts back to the absolute creation, you may have some wiggle room. The other comment I want to make is this three-body or n-body problems are all in the essentially a classical situation. If you do Coulomb, it's possible to solve quantum mechanically the n-body Coulomb problem, scattering problems.
Yeah.
Three-body, n-body, they become very messy, but some of us have done the three-body Coulomb. But that's different from the gravitational, because in the gravitational, everybody is attracting everybody.
Yes.
And in the three-body or n-body Coulomb, some of them are repelling. And so I'm just curious about...
Well, I tell you what. This is a bit music to my ear. Perhaps I could encourage you to look at the Newtonian one. Do you know John Briggs by any chance? John Briggs is an Englishman in Freiburg in Germany, and I nearly got him to work on trying to find out something about the solution of the Newtonian three-body problem. I think there are many interesting issues, particularly with zero angular momentum, zero, one fixed energy and things like this might tell us something about a possible idea of the wave function of the universe. And he made the observation that people like himself, he does a lot of work with helium, and he says that the theoreticians like himself are always trying to catch up with the experimentalists, who with lasers can excite highly excited levels, and then they get some sort of regularity in the de-excitation. And the theoreticians are doing nothing but trying to catch up with them, instead of asking really fundamental questions about things there. So I don't know whether we might talk about that perhaps afterwards.
My knowledge of the classical situation is really quite minimal out of a textbook or things I've taught, but nothing in any profound way. But I know how to solve the quantum mechanical three-body problems or n-body problem for Coulomb scattering. And this is... perhaps can be generalized to gravitational.
Yeah.
Using field
and I would be very interested. Well, perhaps we could get to, because there is Edward Anderson, who's been working with me for a long time and puts out rather long and difficult papers. But he has succeeded now in quantizing my scale invariant three body problem with sort of harmonic oscillator type potentials. But I think that's potentially really quite interesting thing, and maybe we could talk about it before I leave, because I think that they're interesting. And one of the things I wanted to do, and I still want to do, is to get together these very good n-body specialists. There are about 50 people in the world who work on the classical n-body problem as their careers, and I've been lucky enough to get to know four of them pretty well. This ties in with there's also nice issues with the falling cat problem and things like that. So it would be very nice to discuss possibilities on that. Yeah. Any other comments, questions? Oh, well, thanks for stimulating.